Sending your kid or kids to college or university is really, really expensive. It is tuition and books and travel and residence and maybe a little bit of beer money. But the idea is that these costs are offset by the benefits, the joy of learning, perhaps, but certainly the hope that a post-secondary education will earn its recipient more money over time. That's a part of the calculation. Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times, and he has written a new book called The Price You Pay for College. He joins us now from Brooklyn, New York. Hello there.
Hello.
We spoke a while ago about your prior book called The Opposite of Spoiled. We're continuing on the kid theme here. This one talking about education. Why this issue?
Well, people kept showing up, essentially crying in my inbox at the New York Times each spring because they had not really woken up to how much this would cost. They had thought that there would be bigger discounts available for them. And then when they didn't get what they expect, they realized that they had not really studied up on the system and how it had changed. And they realized that it was probably too late and they were begging for help. Yeah.
Right. So the help arrives in the form of a couple hundred pages. Now, Canada and the US are different. The schools are less expensive here. The way we save for it is a bit different. But there's so much the same. You talk about the three main purposes of learning, kinship, and then the, you know, financial opportunity at the end of it all. What has changed in that algorithm since the pandemic arrived?
Well, when everybody gets sent home from their residential undergraduate experience, you lose two of those three things in no small part, right? The learning, it's just fundamentally different. And nobody would argue that it's anywhere close to as meaningful. And in fact, college presidents have been in the New York Times and elsewhere sort of bemoaning how much has been lost. Obviously, the same thing's true with the kinship. You can't spend time with your friends or can't do it in the same way that you used to, and ditto the time that you might have spent bonding with mentors, with professors or administrators or other adults who can have an outsized impact on you and your development. And so when that all goes away, all you're left with is the credential. And then all of a sudden, you're paying the same amount of money for a thing that is nowhere close to what it once was.
The subtitle of this book is A New Roadmap for the Biggest Decision Your Family Will Ever Make. I only have an 11-year-old, so I guess maybe it's too early in the cycle here, but I don't really think of it as a decision. Do you mean if to go or where to go?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, there are an increasing number of people who question the value of it altogether. And it's much easier to do that when you've got an 11 or 12-year-old and you're just sort of spitballing than it is with a 17 or 18-year-old. And maybe all of their peers or most of them are thinking about going to university. But, you know, there are real questions, you know, around is there going to be a shortage of skilled tradespeople? And shouldn't we be paying more attention to channeling more people towards that? So, you know, there is the if question. And then there's the where question. There is the when. When, if ever, is it worth it to pay a whole lot more than whatever the lowest cost option might be? And how do you figure that out? So one of the things I'm trying to do is just develop a list of framing topics and a set of pointed questions for each one that help people begin to determine for themselves where the value might lie and what might be worth paying extra for.
You say part of your purpose is, I hope this book makes you more emotionally honest with yourself. And I love that because I think most of us think, no, I'm good. I am very logical. I am empirical. I am data driven about this. You would argue otherwise.
Well, I mean, who among us makes cool-headed decisions about our children 100% of the time, let alone when five or six-figure amounts of money are involved, and we're dealing with systems and an entire industry that, you know, we may not be familiar with, but we may think we are super familiar with because we did it all 30 years ago or something, right? So we think we're experts, but we're not, right? So emotions like fear and guilt and, you know, snobbery and elitism certainly come into play. And so, you know, I try to walk people through all of those and just to be, you know, much more emotionally honest with themselves about what they're experiencing in their own heads, and then emotionally intelligent about how they navigate the process.
You talk about a number of things that you argue are worth paying for: small class sizes, higher probability of mentoring. You also talk about mental health care. How do you assess the quality of that? Because I think you'll get universal agreement that it's critical. It's so important at that age, at that time in life in particular. How broad a spectrum is there in terms of what different colleges and universities offer?
Well, as a shopper for undergraduate educations, you can't really do a qualitative assessment of the quality of any particular collection of mental health practitioners, but you can ask questions about the system, right? Mm-hmm. Because there is more demand than there is supply on just about every undergraduate campus right now. These schools did not get into business to be, mental health care providers, but they're sort of doing it because they have to, right? So how long do you have to wait for your first appointment? Does the mental health counseling center cap the number of times you can see someone one-on-one? What is the actual ratio of full-time counselors, and not just grad students in training, full-time counselors to undergraduates? You can do a search of the college newspaper and look for articles that have been written, because there are more than a few controversies on undergraduate campuses about both the quantity and the quality of mental health care on these campuses.
Are those data points available at major campuses? I mean, I think those are all good questions. I just have no idea how I, as a parent, would get that information.
No. They're not broadcasting this stuff, on their websites, but every single institution tracks this stuff because they report it to, you know, centralized industry associations, and those industry associations publish the data. So you can be sure that every college is tracking this in some way, shape, or form. They may not be proud of this data, but, you know, part of what I'm trying to do here is raise an army of better informed consumers to ask more pointed questions about things of underestimated importance, right?
And if a thousand parents ask the question, then an institution's going to put it in an annual report, because they're like, oh my God, they all want to know about this. I may as well tell them.
Exactly, right? And, you know, I want people to feel a little more entitled to this information. If, you know, the cost is going to be, you know, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, don't we deserve a little bit more from these places? I think we do.
I would agree on that front. You also say that diversity is worth paying for. And this, it's almost paradoxical, because the examples that you give are, I think, from your experience about all that you learned from high income, low income, visible minorities, all that stuff. And at the same time, the brand equity of the most elite institutions in America, and to a lesser extent Canada, is this world of privilege, its uniformity, its Wall Street, or the best launching pad for the grad school of your dreams. How does that paradox get reconciled?
It's interesting that you see it that way. My sense is that the most selective institutions in the United States would blanch if that is what they knew that you thought of them, because they very much want to stand for something different. That is what they came to stand for, you know, in the 1980s and the 1990s, as they became more selective, but had not yet, you know, turned on to the benefits of a more diverse undergraduate pool of students, right? And so I think they would take issue with that. But where those two things meet is that the challenge with trying to create a diverse environment is, do you end up with an environment where every opinion is actually respected? Or do you end up in a situation where people are relatively atomized and all of the groups that are there don't actually interact as much as you might hope as an educator or an administrator? So, you know, the question I always encourage people to ask is, you know, what opinions around this joint are not welcome, right? What was the last big argument that took place? And who did not feel like their voice was being heard?
Yeah.
So better start there and you see where it goes.
At stereotypically, maybe stereotypical is the wrong word, but at left-leaning colleges, you can imagine that those who have a libertarian view might have a harder time getting a seat at the table.
I think that's probably the case. And so these are why you ask these questions.
Yeah. Diversity is such an interesting question here in Canada because you really only find that at the major universities in the major cities, right? The smaller colleges, people will have to pay a significant amount of money to afford the residents to move to the smaller town to do that. And that takes out, that then it carves up the market in a way that accounts for economic situation to the detriment of diversity.
Yeah, we have similar issues here in the United States. I mean, the president of St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, said to me, look, he said, you know, student shoppers want to learn in diverse environments. And if we can't provide that for them, then we're going to have a problem. But if you're in Minnesota and it's cold and you're an hour from the Twin Cities and there's not a lot of diversity around you in the town or nearby, you're sort of in a pickle, right? Because how do you become more diverse if you can't provide diversity for the diverse populations that don't want to have to do the work of representing other people like them in a small group in front of a large group of white people, right? It's a difficult thing to change on a dime.
You also say career services matter. What's the gold standard? What does the gold standard look like?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question because so many universities in the United States right now are literally blowing their buildings to smithereens and starting over and trying to build something better. I think the question you have to ask yourself is, what is in it for the student who has no idea what they want to do? What sort of counseling does that career center provide? Is there a four-year roadmap that begins with the first year and, sort of helping people find themselves? Is there a thriving internship program where, an internship is guaranteed? As a prospective student, can you ask for the first destination survey such that you can find out, of all 18 religion majors or all 12 Spanish majors, what happened to them a year after they graduated? Where did they go? What did they earn? If the school doesn't have this data, then it's probably not paying enough attention to what is happening to people after they leave. And so that's a pretty good test.
You devote a whole chapter to the College of Worcester. Am I pronouncing that right? Worcester? Never heard of it. It's centered around its independent study approach. How do they do it? And why do you believe that is such a powerful way to do it?
So I spent a lot of time in my reporting trying to find the schools in the United States where the parents' ability to pay was beginning to clash with their willingness to do so. So a whole bunch of relatively selective institutions that still had to fight pretty hard in the marketplace for students such that they have to pay a whole bunch of these, academic merit aid awards to get people to come. And then among those universities and colleges, I tried to find any that were just standing out, that were distinctive. There isn't really that much innovation in undergraduate education here in the United States. It looks a lot like it did a generation ago. So there's some research from Gallup that showed that people who had a mentor and who worked on a long-term project while they were undergraduates tended to be much more satisfied as a result of the experience. And so when I found out that Worcester had, what's essentially a mandatory undergraduate thesis, that sort of struck out for me, right? Stuck out because it's there's mentorship going on. It's a long-term project. And it's a way to get students engaged in the very things that Gallup thought was interesting. And so, I went and visited there in April. Every single person who does one of these independent studies has to present in some way, shape, or form on a Friday in April. And it's like some kind of Woodstock, except at a university. And just the most amazing stuff is on the walls and on the screens. And, I could have spent days doing this. And I thought, this is the kind of thing that I want my kid to experience. So I didn't mean to endorse Worcester per se. Yeah. It's just that we all need to be looking for schools that are doing something distinctive and have a way of talking about it that feels like it'll be meaningful to our families and to our kids in particular.
I read all those examples and I reflected back on my own undergraduate experience, and I was left with one very important question. Do kids not go to keggers anymore? Like, when is the binge drinking? When's the all the stuff of the movies? And certainly that reflected my experience. They seem so grown up and focused and, I don't know, boring.
You know, I probably did not spend enough time at keg parties while I was reporting The Price You Pay for College.
But they still happen.
They still happen. People are drinking. And, you know, there's now all this legal marijuana all over the United States, too. So, you know, you could argue that the mind-altering substances that they're ingesting are, you know, maybe a little bit better for them, or they're at least a little more mellow.
Maybe it's helping. Ron, great work on the book. And thank you for joining us to talk to us about it.
It is my pleasure.
Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. His new book is called The Price You Pay for College. Thankfully, I'm saving for Abby's education, but clearly there is more research to be done.